from Cajamarca, Peru. Mi nombre es Lori Berenson. Among the events of the year, Hurricane Katrina comes to mind as one of the most horrific examples of why the so-called American way of life is so wrong. Here in a third world, Latin American country, the American way of life amounts to images of fast food chains and the military assistance given to tyrants all over the world. It's the free trade agreements the U.S. wants to impose on third world governments. It's the brutal invasion of Iraq. But Hurricane Katrina gave an even clearer image of what the American way of life means, when the rich could flee the area and the poor were left to wait for the storm. While those in the flooded New Orleans spent days on rooftops or crammed into the convention center, many members of the Bush administration continued on vacation. Instead of leading the rescue efforts to save people, a large portion of the U.S. National Guard was busy backing the death and destruction caused by the invasion of Iraq. Greed and individualism are not only negative character traits of some individuals, they are now the motor of our society. The flourishing of the so-called free market is more important than the well-being of people. The right to wealth given to giant companies by that free market allows them to contaminate the environment, causing global warming, while the U.S. government won't sign environmental protection treaties. When U.S. interests are at stake, any measure can be taken. Any war can be waged at any price of human life. Tremendous sums of money are spent daily to kill and destroy in Iraq. However, the budgets for health and education don't grow. This is the American way of life in practical terms. Ironically enough, President Bush insists that we won't let terrorists destroy our way of life. Remembering the suffering experienced in the aftermath of Katrina and the blatant indifference many politicians demonstrated to the people in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, one should wonder why anyone would want to defend that way of life. From Cajamarca, Peru, where I'm serving my 20-year sentence, I'm Lori Berenson.
Next, we'll hear a piece from Active Voices Radio. Timothy Naftali is the director of the Presidential Recordings Project, author of counter-espionage books, and contributor to Slate.com.
Joining us again here on Active Voice Radio to talk about your article that's up this week at Slate.com. It was published, I believe, September 1st, updated September 6th. A Department of Homeland Screw-Up is the title of the article. And you're taking quite a strong stand about the Department of Homeland Security and the Bush administration's reaction in New Orleans. Tell me a little bit about, tell me what you think about this and why you're taking such a strong stand against DOHS.
Well, I recently wrote a history of American counterterrorism, and it is a history that argues, and it starts in World War II and goes through September 11th. I did part of this as a commission for the 9/11 Commission. They asked me to do to study the period 68 through 1993. And one of the chief things that I discovered was that Americans, though they can do it well, do not like to do counterterrorism, particularly at home. And so the blind spot, what gives the book its title, is our unwillingness and inability to think about domestic security. We haven't had a domestic security council. Didn't before 9/11. We had a national security council, but it dealt with foreign threats. The Department of Homeland Security was designed to fill this gap. It was designed to deal with the fact that Americans, and it's painful if you look at this historically, Americans have not really taken the threat of terrorism at home seriously. So when Katrina hit, it was the first test of our ability to respond to a mass casualty event in a city. It was our first chance to see if we had learned the lesson of 40 years of inaction and ineffectiveness in dealing with terrorism. Because one of the things that we did traditionally was we allowed local responders to be overwhelmed before we sent in the cavalry.
We waited. You know, yeah, local officials were required to wait and then make the call.
But the lesson of 9/11, and then repeated by the London bombings this summer, was that we're in a world where the federal government should be the first responder. That it's no longer, it's just, It is quaint and archaic and wrong to have the local police be the first responder in a mass casualty event. And when Katrina hit and the federal government 4, 5, 6 days later still hadn't sent in our active servicemen, I realized that the planning that we've paid millions of dollars for by the Department of Homeland Security is bogus. That we are no more prepared for a mass casualty event today, 4 years after September 11th, than we were on September 10th, 2001, and that is an outrage.
Now let me ask you this. Do you think that the Department of Homeland Security should cease to exist?
Yes.
Immediately.
I think this should be a topic for a much longer discussion. It'll sound glib to your listeners now. But let me give you the short version of this. Politicians, in order to show action, decided that the reforms that we should have after 9/11 were all to be institutional because they're big reforms. You can see them. You build all these new constructs. You have a czar of domestic security, and that's the director of Homeland Security. Bureaucratic reorganization, first of all, it takes a long time to work. It takes years for organizations really to come up to speed. And we just took a bunch of inefficient organizations, slammed them together, put a director of Homeland Security on top of it, and said we've got something better and new. Each agency had to be reformed. The FBI had to be improved so that it dealt with the domestic intelligence problem better. But what they did was they jumbled these things together, and somehow they believed that this would resolve the problem. And that's baloney. The same with the intelligence reform. George Tenet, who was director of Central Intelligence in the summer of 2001, jumped up and down to tell the president, to get the president to understand that Al-Qaeda was a major threat to American security. Now, if you look carefully at what the Bush administration's priorities were in the summer of 2001, you'll find that it was the stem cell issue. It was negotiating a new arrangement with the Soviets so the United States could engage in a missile defense deployment. We were worried about China. Al-Qaeda was not high on our list of priorities. So the president's main intelligence advisor was trying to get his attention, and he didn't succeed. Why a director of national intelligence today should be any more successful at getting a president to focus on something he's not interested in is beyond me. But we needed a new title. We needed to create a new role. We had to show the American people that we were on guard. So we engaged in bureaucratic reform. That's just not the way to do it. I don't see any reason why the Department of Homeland Security can be successful. It's 22 agencies, thousands of employees. It's a big, slow elephant. It's a failure.
We see that bureaucracy kills.
Let me just put it this way. Mother Nature is primarily responsible for the hurricane, but we are responsible for compounding the tragedy by not responding fast enough. And that mistake is a bureaucratic mistake, but it's also a failure of leadership. There are tools available to the president to move the bureaucracies faster, and this president didn't use those tools. I wish we had had tapes. I wish we knew what was going on in his mind when he was in Crawford, but he didn't use the tools available to him, and I think that's the reason why he's apologizing now.
What kind of precedents are there for presidents dealing with this kind of military activation on American soil? There are precedents for this.
Yes, there are precedents. President Kennedy used military force, as did Dwight Eisenhower, in the various civil rights disputes in the South. President Truman actually took over the steel industry. Now, he got into trouble for it. He was slapped on the wrist by the Supreme Court. But this president, for example, could have commandeered Greyhound buses and FedEx trucks. Could have commandeered helicopters, could have commandeered commercial airliners to fly into the airport if he had wanted to. The power of the presidency, there's a sort of a takings clause in the Constitution, and the president could have done these things. And, you know, if he had because he could, his party controls both houses of Congress. If he had told Congress he wanted them to do it, Congress, without any limitation, could have done it. But they didn't. They sat and they twiddled their thumbs for days.
We're speaking with Timothy Naftali, the author of Blind Spot, The Secret History of American Counterterrorism, and also the his latest article at Slate.com is Department of Homeland Screw-Up. Timothy, thank you for taking this extra time to speak with us about this today, and we'll put a link up on our website to this Department of Homeland Screw-Up article at Slate.com as well.
Thanks a lot, Chris. It was my pleasure.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
Is conspiracy just a theory? A common view is that conspiracy exists only in the imaginings of kooks. But just because some people have fantasies about conspiracies doesn't mean that all conspiracies are fantasies. There was the secretive plan to escalate the Vietnam War, as revealed in the Pentagon Papers, that was deliberately manipulating U.S. opinion and hiding things from the public and saying, let's keep this secret from the public. There was the Watergate break-in, which under the law was a criminal conspiracy. There was the Federal Bureau of Investigation's COINTELPRO disruption of dissident groups, done undercover and denied, and yet it was happening. There was the several phony but well-orchestrated energy crises that sharply boosted oil prices in the 1970s and again in the 90s. There was the Iran-Contra conspiracy. There was the savings and loan conspiracies involving upwards of $1 trillion stolen from the American public. And the well-documented conspiracies and the conspiracy to cover up the assassinations of President John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. Ruling elites admit to conspiring in secret without being held accountable to anyone. They call it national security. But when one suggests that their plans, whether covert or overt, benefit the interests of their class and are intended to do so, one is dismissed as a conspiracy theorist. The minute we ascribe conscious agency and conscious intent to the people who control enormous amounts of power and wealth, somebody says, oh, that's a conspiracy you have, which puts a closure on any critical investigation of these people. It's admitted that farmers, steel workers, or school teachers may concert to advance their interests. They may plan and agitate and try to get things done that advance their interests and with real intention. But it may not be suggested that the moneyed elites, the giant corporate investors, it may not be suggested that they do so, even when they actually occupy the top decision-making posts. Instead, we are asked to believe that these notable persons of high station walk through life indifferent to the fate of their vast holdings. Although there is no one grand power elite, there is continual cooperation between various corporate and governmental elites in every area of the political economy. Many of the stronger corporate groups tend to predominate in their particular spheres of interest, more or less unmolested by other elites. In any case, the conflicts among plutocratic interests seldom work to the advantage of the people. Their conflicts of haves versus haves. Often they're resolved not by compromise but by log rolling, involving more collusion than competition. These mutually satisfying arrangements among competitors usually come at the expense of the public interest. Some people argue that it's not conspiracy operating, it's class structure or the system as a totality. But that system has to rely on conspiratorial ploys from time to time to make things happen. And that system is not a neutral entity. It is there to serve, with every intention, to serve the interests of the ruling elites. And these ruling elites take great care in maintaining their advantages within that system. So rather than saying, is it conspiracy or is it social structure? Is it conspiracy or is it class power? We should learn that it's both. It's conspiracy and class power. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org.
We've run out of time for labor news, which was scheduled to be next, but find it for yourself at radioforall.net. 20% of nurses have already left the profession. Next, we have Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ben Dupuy, co-director of the Haiti Progrès newspaper, who examines the chaotic Haitian presidential election and the suspicions of many that democracy there is once again being undermined. Maren Smith, director of the British Columbia Coastal Program for Forest Ethics, who discusses the successful struggle to preserve 5 million acres of Canada's Great Bear Forest. And Max Sawicki of the Economic Policy Institute, who takes a critical look at President Bush's proposed 2007 budget that rewards the powerful and punishes the weak. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the price of crude oil hovering over $60 a barrel, new energy barons in Canada are looking to cash in. Vast reserves of oil sands, sometimes called tar sands, are surging in value in Western Canada as part of a larger rush to supply the energy-hungry United States. According to E, the environmental magazine, the province of Alberta and the federal government in Ottawa have granted huge tax breaks for oil sands development, which was condemned by environmentalists. Activists say expanded oil sands development would add 70 megatons of greenhouse gas emissions a year, and over 2,500 acres of boreal forest would be destroyed. In the process, 225,000 oil wells would be drilled and over 450,000 miles of access roads would be built in the Alberta wilderness. Once fully developed, Canada's oil sands could produce 300 million barrels of oil, making Canada only second in oil reserves to Saudi Arabia. Energy investors plan to spend $70 billion to make it happen. The Sierra Club of Canada says developing the oil sands in Alberta will violate the nation's commitment to the Kyoto Protocol on global warming. The group calls tar sands one of the most eco-destructive industries on the planet. In a massive 1,000-page decision, the World Trade Organization ruled that a 6-year European Union moratorium on the importation of genetically modified crops violated international trade rules. The preliminary ruling ratified a complaint filed in 2003 by the United States, Canada, and Argentina. According to media reports, the WTO ruled in favor of biotech exporting nations on most of the 25 crops in dispute. In addition, the WTO overturned GM bans in the nations of Austria, France, Germany, Italy, Greece, and Luxembourg. In 2004, the EU ended its import ban on GM crops, but required labeling. Over the 6-year EU moratorium, the U.S. biotech industry claims farmers lost $300 million a year in lost sales and may seek compensation from the EU. Critics say that GM foods pose a potential health hazard. Besides squashing the GM bans in selected European countries, the biotech industry hopes the WTO decision will convince African nations like Zimbabwe and Ethiopia to rethink their objections to GM food. As Alexandra Wandel of Friends of the Earth Europe stated, Europe should fight this decision. The WTO undermines democracy and puts business interests before the welfare of the public. It should not be allowed to rule on what we eat or what our farmers grow. While the global diamond trade has claimed to reform its practices around so-called conflict diamonds, raw gems are still mined by rebel and terrorist groups operating in the West African states of Liberia and Ivory Coast. A pre-Valentine's Day alert by Amnesty International and Global Witness found conflict diamonds being smuggled into neighboring nations for export to Europe and the United States. In the 1990s, 200,000 people were killed in a bloody civil war in Liberia, then under the control of Charles Taylor, who is now in exile in Nigeria. Trading in illicit diamonds funded the regime. According to the London-based Independent newspaper, rebels in conflict-ridden Ivory Coast smuggle diamonds into Mali and sell them on the international market. In 2003, the diamond industry instituted a voluntary program, the Kimberley Process, to eliminate the trade in conflict diamonds. It created a conflict-free certificate that was attached to all shipments of raw diamonds. A survey of diamond retailers by human rights groups found only 11% of U.S. stores had a policy on conflict diamonds. Human rights campaigners are advising consumers to ask diamond retailers about the source of the jewelry they are thinking of purchasing and requesting a written guarantee from the diamond supplier proving it is conflict-free. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
The first national election conducted in Haiti since the February 2004 overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide descended into chaos after charges were made that vote totals had been manipulated to prevent a former president and Aristide ally from claiming outright victory. The February 7th vote was disorganized but largely peaceful. However, when preliminary vote totals appeared to show that presidential candidate René Préval had won just less than 49% of the ballots, falling short of the 50% plus one votes needed to avoid a runoff, militant protests by his supporters erupted throughout the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince, with reports that UN peacekeeping forces had killed several demonstrators. Of more than 2 million ballots cast, about 125,000 ballots have been declared invalid due to irregularities, raising suspicion among Préval supporters that polling officials were rigging the election. A member of Haiti's Electoral Council, Pierre Richard Duchemin, charged that the vote count was being manipulated and called for an investigation. On February 14th, Préval declared victory and said he was convinced there was massive fraud and gross errors that affected the process. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ben Dupuy, co-director of the Haiti Progrès newspaper and formerly President Aristide's ambassador at large, who assesses the flawed ballot count and the concern of many that democracy in Haiti is once again being undermined.
So I think what's going on is that the U.S. engineered this kind of election the way they're doing it in to some extent, the way they're doing it in Iraq today, parachuted some kind of an interim government, a puppet government, and they organized this electoral council, and then at the last, I think, few months, they impose a kind of a manager of this electoral council. And it seems it's the man who has been trying to manipulate the results. The very first day that they started to give partial results, it was very clear that René Préval was way ahead with more than 70% of the vote. And then gradually this was being scaled down. And the 13th, finally, they say that he had 48.6%, which means the whole thing is to force a second round, and I think that's where the whole thing is. They don't want to accept the victory of René Préval. So now there are more very important thing happening. We got a dispatch stating that U.S. have landed 800 soldiers in the Dominican Republic, which is in the southern part of the Dominican Republic, which is very an area very close to the border with Haiti. And according to some groups in the Dominican Republic, there are presently about 14,000 U.S. troops in the Dominican Republic. And we know that February 13, Brazil have called for an emergency meeting of the Security Council of the United Nations. And most probably, it's to deal with the so-called crisis in Haiti. And we have to also beware that the 15th of February is the deadline for the MINUSA, which means this international occupation force in Haiti. So it's very clear that I think this emergency meeting is either to renew the mandate or to once more give the United States the green light to reinforce the MINUSA by having their troops poised in the Dominican Republic to move in. So I think we're in for some events.
Ben Dupuy, René Préval's closest opponent in this presidential election in Haiti is a former president himself, Leslie Manigat, with an estimated 11.8% of the vote. Who does Leslie Manigat represent? And if the vote is indeed being manipulated, as members of the Electoral Council are claiming, could it be to present Leslie Manigat as a force for stability and manipulations of a future runoff election to put him in the president's chair?
Well, Leslie Manigat is some kind of a Christian Democrat. In fact, when they say he was a former president of Haiti, I would say that he was a former de facto president. In fact, he was put there after the army just spoiled an election by massacring would-be voters and disrupting that electoral process and then making their own election. And they just impose Manigat, but the very army that put him in power also made a coup and removed him from office. So I think he stayed there for about just a few months. And so I don't think we can compare Manigat with either President Aristide or former President René Préval. He is a conservative. He is, somebody who I think, because he is way behind Préval in that kind of manufactured election. But if they claim that Préval has 48%, that's the latest figure that the so-called Electoral Council have come out with, this means that they could form a coalition for the second round with all the other factions, and that way they could engineer, a victory for Manigat. But in the meantime, the people have taken to the street, and practically the country is at a standstill. Already the MINUSA have opened fire on people demonstrating against this manipulation. As far as information we have, so far 4 people have been killed.
That was Ben Dupuy, co-director of the newspaper Haiti Progrès. Contact Haiti Progrès by calling area code 718-434-8100 or visit their website at www.haitiprogres.com. On February 7th, an agreement was reached to protect the world's largest remaining temperate coastal rainforest from destructive logging. Environmentalists, representatives of First Nations Indigenous peoples, logging companies, and the government of British Columbia, Canada, agreed to protect 5 million acres of the Great Bear Rainforest, about the size of New Jersey, and to allow only sustainable logging in the 10 million remaining acres of the vast rainforest. The victory was built on a struggle in the early and mid-1990s to save the old-growth forest in Clackwat Sound on Vancouver Island, British Columbia. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Maren Smith, director of the British Columbia Coastal Program for Forest Ethics, an organization based in Canada and the U.S. that is committed to protecting endangered forests. She discusses the evolution of the struggle and key elements in which it differed from past conservation efforts.
The protests on Clackwat really were the beginning of the campaign to protect the Great Bear Rainforest, where we realized there was large wild ecosystems left where we could protect not just the little bits that were left, but we could protect a whole intact ecosystem where the predator-prey relationships, they call it, where the grizzly bears and the wolves and the salmon could still roam.
How did you go about organizing the campaign to save the Great Bear Rainforest based on the experiences that you'd had in the previous campaign?
It started with protests, and it started with groups like Forest Ethics going to the marketplace to companies like Home Depot and Lowe's and saying, this is what you're buying. You're buying the destruction of this globally significant temperate rainforest. This area, the Great Bear Rainforest, has one quarter of the world's remaining temperate rainforest. So it's rare, and it is enormously globally significant. It has grizzly bears, wild salmon. 20% of the world's wild salmon spawn in this region. It has eagles, black bears, and you've probably heard about the rare spirit bear, which is a genetically unique black bear that's white, and this is the only place where those bears live.
What are the lessons to be learned from your successful effort here? What did the parties who wanted to save this huge area do differently from past campaigns that made it work?
I think there's a few things that were key. For us, for the conservation sector, first of all, we had power. We had the power of the marketplace behind us. We had Home Depot and Lowe's and the German pulp and paper industry and other buyers of BC wood products behind us saying, you know what? And they're talking to the logging companies and the BC government, and they're saying, you know, this is not good enough, what you are doing here. These forest practices are not good enough for this globally significant area. And that changed the power dynamic. And that allowed us to really demand that a conservation orientation took place during the whole process of the decisions being made. The second thing that was really important was everybody agreed at that point that we would have an independent science team that helped inform the land use decisions. So not the government scientists, not the forest company scientists, but we all agreed on a team of scientists to advise things going forward. The third part was that the First Nations became, I don't know if it's right to say they were empowered enough or that they were actually being listened to at this point, but they also created their own land use plans. And, you know, the First Nations, the indigenous people in the region, really have some strong conservation interests and wanted to see some of the significant areas from a biodiversity perspective were also significant areas for them, for their culture and for their history. So where the salmon runs were strong, the biodiversity was interest to us, the conservation sector. That was also where the First Nations were interested in having those areas protected. So that's another significant factor. And I think a very, very important thing, a very key factor, was that we, at some point, we had to step out of ourselves and say, okay, let's think creatively and innovatively and try to find a solution that is going to meet these other parties' needs. You know, I'm listening to these First Nations who live here and who want jobs for their communities. How can we creatively come up with solutions for that? So, for instance, what we did then was we turned to investors in the United States and Canada and said, you're interested in conservation. Will you invest in these communities to develop conservation-based programs and to develop conservation-based businesses? And we have raised a total of almost $60 million right now, and we are looking to get that matched by the Canadian government, both provincially and the federal government, so that there is a package of funds. It's not for compensation or anything like that for the First Nations, but it's for their communities so that they can create jobs based on conservation. It's to help catalyze conservation-based businesses. This area is really Canada's Amazon, and this agreement is really going to be a gift to the planet. It's British Columbia's gift to the planet. We really are hoping that this is a model that will get taken to other endangered forests in the world.
So what's the next step in this process?
I think it's really important that we all remain vigilant and monitor and ensure that these agreements actually hit the ground and aren't just press announcements and great words last week. Because making these agreements become reality is the big challenge, making them change the way the economy and forest practices are. So we really hope that everybody will maintain their interest and help us continue pressure on the government and industry to make sure that this truly is a conservation victory.
That was Maren Smith of British Columbia Coastal Program for Forest Ethics. Contact the program's San Francisco office at area code 415-863-4563 or visit the group's website at www.forestethics.org. As his popularity continues to wane, President George W. Bush unveiled his proposed 2007 federal budget, which seems designed to reward the powerful and punish the weak. The budget would make permanent tax cuts that primarily benefit the nation's wealthiest sector, totaling about $3 trillion over 10 years. At the same time, the president is demanding that some of the tax cut shortfalls be made up in $65 billion in cuts from vital social programs, including education, job training, and child care. Medicare would see a $36 billion reduction, resulting in increased premiums from wealthy seniors. Among those on the receiving end of the president's budget would be the Pentagon, which would get a 7% increase, and the Department of Homeland Security, which would get an 8% boost. Mr. Bush wants Congress to allocate another $50 billion to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but expects that it will actually cost $70 billion. The White House projects that if passed, Mr. Bush's budget will increase the federal deficit to a record $423 billion, but hopes to trim that number by almost $70 billion through proposed cuts. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Max Sawicki, an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, who assesses the winners and losers in the Bush budget and the possible moderating effect of this year's congressional elections.
The tax cuts are stacked overwhelmingly towards high-income people, including the very rich. On average, a tax cut for somebody in the middle is around $600, and tax cut for somebody making over $1 million is $100-something thousand. That's on a yearly basis. So there's not much mystery that the tax cuts are stacked towards the wealthy. On the other side, the spending cuts are gratuitously nasty, targeted at pretty vulnerable populations without a great deal of political voice. And that means, in particular, cuts pertaining to social services, daycare, care of the indigent, care of the handicapped, that sort of thing. A lot of that is done by state governments through grants provided by the federal government, and cuts in grants to the states will mean that those services either contract or you'll see your state and local taxes go up to replace that money. One of those two things has to result from this sort of policy. So the general pattern is you get talk about deficit reduction. The deficit goes up if you take the budget. The spending increases in the budget are going towards defense and homeland security. A lot of the defense is basically weapon systems to fight enemies that no longer exist. And, of course, a good part of the defense is also the actual war going on in Iraq and, to a lesser extent, Afghanistan.
Is there any evidence to support the notion that tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans help the economy?
Well, we've had an excellent kind of experiment over the last 20 years. We had in 92 the economy not doing well, record deficits being projected when Clinton came into office, and they increased taxes in a way that would narrow the deficit, that would reduce the deficit. And the economy was still sluggish for a while, but the 90s turned out to be pretty good in terms of economic growth. The latter half of the 90s were particularly good for wage growth, even for low income, for low wage people. So you had a tax increase, which was focused on the wealthiest people, including an increase in the top rate. And the economy righted itself and after the years of Bush won and did pretty well. Now, here we are. We had a recession in 2001, a mild one by historic standards. We had big tax reductions. And the performance of the economy is markedly inferior to what happened after the tax increase. In particular, in terms of job growth, if you compare this recovery to the previous ones, it's way, way below average. Real wage growth has been practically absent. much worse than previous recoveries. So by the standards of the outcome in the most important major economic factors like employment and wages, if we want to attribute this outcome to these tax cuts that we've had, then these would have to be the most colossal blunder in economic policy history. So by the evidence of what has actually happened now, in contrast to after we increased taxes in the 90s to reduce the deficit, these tax cuts have been a gigantic flop.
Max Sawicki, politically, is this proposed Bush administration budget dead on arrival? And what do you think the Congress is going to do with it, given that this is an election year where the Republicans certainly have a lot of vulnerable seats around the country?
Well, the big factors right now politically are not about the budget. They're about all the other exciting things going on, namely pending indictments of people, members of Congress, top staffers, maybe more people in the executive branch. You've got the disappointments in terms of the progress of the mission in Iraq. That sort of scandal factor has really become the front and center of politics. That's going to be center stage, I think, and the budget's going to be more of a sideshow this year. Now, it could affect the budget because most of that bad stuff is afflicting the Republicans, and if they're in a more defensive posture, they might be less aggressive in terms of fulfilling the president's request. I mean, they've never been very aggressive to begin with, and since they figure the most extreme conservatives have nowhere else to go, they could try to sort of appease people that are more moderate, and rather than actually cut spending as the president has been saying he wants, they could go much more strongly in the opposite direction and end up bringing in even more spending than we've seen. The other part of this is that there hasn't been any penalty on the administration economically for increasing the deficit. The economists in the mainstream for years and years have predicted huge problems resulting from deficits in the short term in terms of interest rates going up and all kinds of disruption wrought by that. But that has not occurred. The big difference, which nobody anticipated, is that foreigners have been perfectly happy to keep lending the U.S. money. And the funny thing about this is that the biggest lenders in this situation are the central banks of Japan and the People's Republic of China. And it also happens to be the case that the job growth we have seen, although it's been mediocre, has been mostly accounted for by increase in government jobs. So you have the result of this purported conservative revolution where the economic performance is based on government jobs, based on borrowing from the communist Chinese.
That was Max Sawicki, an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Contact the Institute by calling them at area code 202-775-8810 or visit their website at www.epi.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalot, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. And in the background is Avalon by Amethystium. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be exploring people's history with an interview of Steve Fowle on the New Hampshire Gazette calendar and a broadcast of Peter Sumsuch's talk on the history of nonviolent actions given in January in Portsmouth. We leave you with this quote from Aubrey de Vere. Prejudice, which sees what it pleases, cannot see what is plain.